Hello, this is Aaron, and welcome back to the podcast. I'm excited today to have special guest Dr. Nicholas Ellis, who is the founder of Christian Halls, an organization that is reinventing Christian higher education. You can check them out at christianhalls.org, and there's a link in the show notes. So since your name in the display that you put in is Nick, how about I just call you Nick instead of Dr. Ellis?
Please do.
But thank you for joining us. Before we dig in, I first want to just remind people, if you didn't see it in last week's digest, I'm going to be speaking at a conference called Clear Speech for a Confused Age in Cincinnati next weekend. It's the 13th, 14th, and 15th. It's hosted by Christ the King Church. If you're able to get there, that would be great. And again, I put a link to the conference in the show notes. You can check that out. And as you can tell, I managed to pick up a cold, and my voice isn't doing so well. So hopefully that will mean I'll talk less and our guests will talk more. So Nick, again, thank you for joining. And you have a really interesting personal story that took you from like homeschooled in Brazil to Oxford and back to the United States. To give people a little bit of overview of who you are and your journey, which is really interesting.
Yeah, it's great. Well, they say all story is biography. And very much a product of my family and my heritage. My mom's a Montana Mennonite farm girl, born in, kind of the Alberta, northern Montana area, and just a really rich heritage of family and entrepreneurship and godliness. And then she married my dad, kind of coming out of the Jim Elliott era of missions. And kind of, if you're a Montana Mennonite farm girl in that era, you either farm or you go on the mission field. And so we moved to Brazil when I was young, grew up in the North Amazon. And, back in those days, you really had a couple, mainly two options. Most parents sent their kids off to boarding school. And my parents had the foresight to say, we're not going to do that. They filled a crate with books and basically started a 5,000 volume classical library in the North Amazon for us. And so my childhood was spent fishing tucunaré, peacock bass in the Amazon tributaries, or reading great books. And that was kind of our whole kind of early formation of reading through great Western literature, really engaging in the Christian intellectual tradition. And that has actually blossomed across Brazil and has become what we now call Classical Press Brazil, which is really the first classical and homeschooling publishing house, because many people began to come to us and say, wow, where would we get this literature? So that was a major influence in my life, obviously. Continue to work with my parents in Brazil. They've been there 28 years now. But then I left Brazil for university, pursued linguistics and classics and biblical studies. That took me from the States, traveled to Germany, was there for a year, Israel from Hebrew studies, and Dead Sea Scrolls, kind of got into Jewish studies. That eventually took me to Oxford, where I did my master's and my doctorate. And that's when I really began to start to kind of think deeply about what is the history and the future of Christian education, especially when it relates to forming flourishing communities. I'm a university man. I love the university. Education's been a major part of my life. Benefited enormously from the universities that I was part of, but especially because of our work in the field across Brazil and increasingly in the States, begin to get a sense that our universities are very good at a number of things, but they're also very good at extracting talent and treasure with very little ways of sending them back to local communities. And begin to have this just niggling thought, are our institutions still serving the constituents that they were built for? And that became a big dominant question in my mind that has really governed a lot of my work over the last 20 years. Who serves whom when it comes to the institution, the educational space? And so I'd say that might be a good jumping off point, right, of where this has taken us.
Yeah. So you moved back from Oxford to Texas. So you're now back in the United States. Mm-hmm. And you created Christian Halls as sort of a product of all of this formation that you had, essentially, and the gaps that you thought. So what is it? And especially what is the actual model that you're trying to do and what you're trying to accomplish through it?
Yeah, that's good. Well, much of this was created by us working in all of these different communities across North America and Brazil, and seeing that in many ways we have abandoned what I would call natural eldership as a primary source for human formation and wisdom. So we have all of these subject matter experts and retired people and people who have invested their life in their areas and their vocation. And we have basically abandoned that resource as a primary source of the formation of not just knowledge, but wisdom. And that was a major point of concern for me. I firmly believe that education and human formation, the formation of good people in the soul, is not just a question of data transmission, but is the process of forming wisdom. And by exchanging wisdom for data, you get entire companies, Google, full of very, very knowledgeable people with no wisdom and no source or sense of how to get wisdom and integrate, you know, faith and knowledge and community and shalom and health and all these kind of things. So that was really the first thing, is that I started to see that, you know, frankly, treating the professors at our universities as the sole or primary source of learning and knowledge may not be the best way of thinking about human formation. And then second of all, I knew I didn't want to have to start a new college every single town that I went to. That is not fiscally responsible or good stewardship of our resource, nor is it remotely possible. And so we were just starting to enter in to the age where, you know, Coursera was emerging, Udacity was coming out. I had worked for an organization called Bible Mesh doing online education. And I saw some of the potential in terms of scale and efficiencies and those kind of things in terms of the online space, but was also very deeply distrusting of the formational capacity of online education. And having worked in the industry, I can tell you it's a running internal joke. Yes, we can do as much formational work online as we can in person. It's just not true. And we know it's not true. And everybody in the industry knows it's not true. But there are things that we can do that are quite good. You know, we can basically write really, really good digital textbooks. Mm-hmm. And so what I saw happening was kind of a culmination of a very long historical narrative of the first 1,000 years of Christian history being kind of embedded in the monastic communities for local formation. And then the second 1,000 years of Christian history beginning to move out of those monastic communities into the cathedral schools and the universities and the centralization into institutions. And I said, I think there might be a way of reunifying those two narratives, because we have universities with a tremendous amount of overstock, if you will, mm-hmm. A lot of product. They invested enormous amounts of resources to develop all of these online courses and accreditation and whatnot.
And declining enrollment.
Yes, in a space with declining enrollment. And many of our Christian universities, thinking that online education would be their great salvation, suddenly all of these students are going to come in and they're going to find tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of students. And what they don't realize is that content, which they were developing, very good content may be king, but distribution's queen and she wears the pants, baby. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have distribution, you've got nothing. And our universities were running into the wood chipper of Purdue Global and Liberty and Grand Canyon and Arizona State, spending hundreds of millions of dollars on marketing. And now we have all of these Christian colleges that just simply can't compete in the space. So effectively what I did is I said, I think I can go acquire the right to go take those programs and deploy them into a humane space, a human local mentorship space, and effectively created a guild of local tutors. And so began to go to various communities and say, if I could bring you an accredited course or bundle or gen ed bundle or community college alternative or even a full degree program, would you, local theologian, pastor, pilot, nurse, be willing to take a mentorship and formational role in that space. And the model that I followed was nothing more than the Oxford-Cambridge tutorial model, where you're getting a degree from the University of Oxford, but you're receiving your weekly tutorials in college. And I just took the Oxford model. And from a supply chain perspective, went out to our universities and said, let me take your university degrees and I will go build community-based, incarnational, locally mentored distribution hubs and give governance back to those local communities in terms of formation and mentorship and program selection and the kind of the tutorial guild side. So universities, you do what you're good at, creating product, accreditation, technology, those kind of things. But let's return governance of the space back to where God created it, within the family, within the local community of faith, and in some ways turn the power dynamics back to the client, back to the local community. And that was kind of a revolutionary idea, even though it's kind of a simple idea, because what's happened in the educational space is that we have lost governance to institutions that in many ways are unaccountable. So if I send my child off to such and such Christian university and my son comes back a girl, who do I hold accountable? Do I write a nasty letter to the president and say, hey, I'm not going to pay you any alumni dollars? There's no accountability there. Whereas if the local community is saying, you're not bringing us good product, you're not bringing us the right kind of materials that's held to a good, solid standard, Orthodox Christian perspective, those kind of things, we fire you. We're going to fire you, or we're going to find other providers and vendors. And I think that that power dynamic of returning governance to the local community of faith is heading us in the right direction towards not just burning down all of the institutions, because we're kind of faced with this question. What do we do in an educational environment that is completely overrun with debt, completely ideologically bereft, siphoning off our talent and treasure from local communities? You know, what do we do in an environment where the vendors are running the show? Well, we can burn it all down. We can try to go build brand new structures, or we can try to redeem and repurpose and reutilize institutions in their proper telos, for their proper form. And I wanted to try to do that instead of just kind of abandoning all of our existing institutions. I wanted to try to find a way of using what they have been gifted and stewarded with, but repurposing to serve the needs of the community of faith. So that's kind of how we've come. And so just very pragmatically speaking, what we've designed now, the Christian Hall, is a local tutor-led, elder-governed micro-campus. May have a local facility, may not have a local facility. Maybe it's meeting in a church or a business. We work with a lot of homeschool groups for dual credit to kind of a gen ed program. A lot of private schools. We've got everything from dual credit through graduate PhD programs. You know, that's our supply chain. And we then come to these communities and say, how can we best serve this community through an educational program? Where are the mentors that are willing to stand up and be counted? And how can we serve this particular need? At its simplest, kind of probably most understandable model, we are trying to build a county by county Christian community college and trade school alternative to compete against a local community college. And we can flex up in terms of elite programs or other things, but at scale, that's probably the best way to describe what we're trying to do strategically.
So let me repeat back what I heard in kind of Aaron speak and see if I got it right. It sounds like what you did is you went out to these colleges, Christian colleges for the most part, mm-hmm. who already had accredited online degree or certification programs, and you essentially cut a wholesale deal with them. And you said, let me have access to your catalog of courses. I'll market them. I'll distribute them. I'll sell them for you. You know, if you kind of like give me this deal. And then you go to communities and a group of people who are interested in creating some sort of a local school. And you say, I got this menu of courses from X different schools mm-hmm. that people can take. And you create essentially a small college in your institution. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to create the curriculums or get the accreditations, but you can essentially, you know, other than, you know, the grading and the transcripts, you basically run your own affairs on that. Is that kind of how
that's exactly it? So that campus then that you called it a college. And if I was in England, I would call it a college. Here in the States, the language gets murky. You know, we're not a U.S. college, but we are a little collegiate group, a little guild of tutors and mentors that have gathered together to mentor and teach and support our community members through their educational pathway. And we do that completely outside of the governance of the university, of Title IV, of the government, because as far as they're concerned, we're a glorified tutoring group.
What's Title IV for people who don't know?
Title IV would be federal loans, okay. the Department of Education coming and saying...
So student loans. So basically people who go through this thing don't take on debt. You know, there's not a debt arm to this thing.
That's right. And the way we've been able to do that is to structure, because we now can come in and restructure the financial piece to say, instead of having to write a $27,000 check August 15th to pay for your semester, we can come in and restructure the finances. So it's, you know, in this community in Western Montana, the average purchasing power, you know, of the individual should be able to afford about $250 a month. And let's structure the financial payment. So it's really radically rethinking how we can structure the finances. And then also, there's two things that we negotiate. First of all, the local price point. And second of all, we take a percentage of that tuition and we use it to pay those local tutors and mentors. So it's a sustainable local operation. Those are the two main financial pieces that we brought to the table.
How many of these and how many students do you actually have up and running?
Yeah, so we're operational in Brazil, U.S., and a couple sites in Uganda. Across our micro campuses and all the various programs that we run, of which there's numerous. 4 years ago, we had six campuses and 90 students. Today, this year, we'll be at 350 micro campuses, and we'll be crossing 10,000 students. So pretty substantial growth based around basically local mentors stepping up and saying, hey, we'd like to run one of these.
When these things get up and running, do they still have like a kind of a tether to you in some way? Or we say it's local governments, they kind of run their own affairs. Are they still dependent on you for the access to the courses?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I wrestle with this because I did not, the moment I saw this growing, I had this flash of Lord of the Rings. We're gathering around the Ring of Power, and this should not be governed by one individual or a central group. There needs to be a fellowship that really does, you know, govern this space. Our basic philosophy is we don't want to franchise it. We don't want to centralize ownership, but we do want to constrain who do we work with. So if some local community goes off the rails, how do we constrain that? And basically the way that we've set it up is that each of our client sites, each of these Christian halls are locally owned and operated and governed. We have the right to issue them an operating agreement to use our programs, to use our degree programs and our courses and the other things that we brokered from our universities. And should they go off the rails based on the contract that they sign, we have the right to pull our products and our programs from them. We can't shut them down. You know, we can't tell them to cease and desist operations because they are a locally owned and operated site. But we do have some governance in the ability of saying, we're not going to work with you in terms of a product distribution. If you basically deviate from Nicene Orthodox Christianity, that's kind of the group that we want to work within.
Yeah. You know, you talked a lot about local governance and keeping things in the community. The language to me has a little bit of a libertarian flair to it. Do you have any sort of like philosophical kind of like underpinning of that or not? I'm just curious, like why the focus on like the local and the governance and all that?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I would be a lowercase libertarian. I would say that I think that local understands its needs best, especially when it comes to formation of people. And so what are the kind of programs, what are the kinds of mentorship, who would they want to entrust their children into the hands of, you know, and that answer is best answered through a local question. So when I go into a community, typically what I'll do, so we have a partnership running out of Brady, Texas, you know, central Texas, deep in the heart of Texas. I was invited to come speak at the local Rotary Club, presented what we're doing. And I just said, here's a big draft board. Where are the mentors, tutors, businessmen, you know, that would like to run, you know, apprenticeship programs in their local companies, or retired school teachers or retired nurses that would like to govern this program? And who would you entrust your children with? What I am finding is that some of these words are going to be dirty words in the modern ecosystem, but the dynastic patriarchs and matriarchs of those local communities that have been there 3 to 4 generations are the ones that say, we care about the long-term viability of our community. Mm-hmm. They know who they trust. They know who's flaked. They know who they would want to work with. They know what business we should avoid when we set up a local apprenticeship, work, study, and trade program. And so if I try to govern this centrally, I lose that kind of local input. And so I'm trying to, and I would say the other thing that I'm doing, we're not actually in student acquisition. Our organization is actually fundamentally in elder creation, elder resourcing, because what got us into this mess in the first place was the abdication of local eldership, mentorship, you know, patrician education within the family, and shifting that responsibility off to what had proven to be poor institutional stewards. And so when I say local governance, actually what I'm trying to do is cross the spiritual and intellectual and emotional barrier of saying, but we couldn't possibly. Like, well, do you think that that local secular community college down the road is doing it better? They're not. And so I'm trying to stimulate governance and ownership in that community for those elders, those leaders to stand up and say, we're going to take this back. Because I can provide all the product lines. I can provide the educational programming. I can provide the blueprinting. I can provide the financial models. But what I can't do is I can't substitute local leadership. So that's why I'm really kind of doubling down on local governance, because I actually think that that ends up being the key to making this whole thing work.
What kinds of organizations have been interested in creating one of these?
It's good. Well, there's I would say 5 prototypical client profiles that we look for when we come into a community. The first one, and probably the easiest one, is your local homeschool co-op. They're used to being alternative and weird and figuring this stuff out. And they've already said, hey, we're going to be involved in the lives of our kids. And a lot of these moms are watching their kids kind of graduate, and yet they have access to all of the local talent. They are ready to step into that role. And all I kind of need to get them to do is like a 13th grade, you know, and if I can get them to do an accredited general education 13th grade and knock off the English Comp 1 and 2 and the philosophy and the psych and the history and the American government classes, kind of the poison classes that a lot of these parents and students hate at their local university or community college. If I can get them to do a 13th grade, I can definitely get them to do a 14th grade and at least take that whole kind of first 2 years off the table. So homeschool co-ops are kind of bread and butter, easy entrance points from a cultural perspective. There's good things and there's bad things about them, you know, that we don't need to get into, but that's a good initial client. The second would be, with a little bit more bureaucratic barrier, would be your local private school. And so we're working with a lot of private schools here in Dallas-Fort Worth. There are 350,000 students in the 3 community colleges in DFW, Dallas, Tarrant, and Collin County Community Colleges. There's not a single Christian university that is targeting that student population base, you know, Hispanic, African-American, Anglo, looking to transfer out, looking to avoid debt. That whole space, plus the trade school space, we don't have a single accredited Christian trade school in the state of Texas. And we completely abdicated the trade space. Well, when I go to these local schools, these local private schools, and they're basically empty from 4 to 9, there's the opportunity of both layering in dual credit and 13th grade, 14th grade kind of stuff into their existing student population. But I'm finding that there's a very strong desire to reach out to the broader community and say, hey, all of these kids that are around us that are going to a secular community college, let's bring them to our campus. Let's use our teachers. Let's use our community and reach out to our community. And there, I just have to get people to stop thinking about themselves as a high school. Mm-hmm. That somehow the 12th grade buzzer goes ding. And suddenly that means that we've abdicated any kind of governance in this space to random other stewards. And so that's been very productive for us. The local business community is just an amazing, amazing advocate for what we're doing, because they probably more than anyone else feel the existential crisis of the lack of humane development of good citizens. And so, you know, just not having employees, not being able to find good people. And so we have a very close partner that runs a network of restaurants across across Texas. We entered into a partnership with them, and they gave us one of their stores to basically place work study apprenticeship students, paying for their dual credits, providing a human formational space, business entrepreneurship, those kind of things. And we took that store since November from 4 employees doing about $7,000 of revenue. They now have 30 employees in that store. They've tripled their revenue and are now beginning to really build out an apprenticeship model within their overall organization to build their own kind of humane development of quality people. And I would say that our business community, more than anyone else, kind of sees the opportunity, is grabbing our students and saying, wow, this is the future of our company. So homeschool co-ops, private schools, the Christian business community, independent scholars that are out there that are retired, that love their work, pilots that want to, you know, mentor people in our pilot and aviation program. We're finding those individual scholars that want to work with us. We're beginning to move into the Christian camps, because there's a lot of these Christian camps and conference centers all over the country that from October to May are basically empty, but the great facilities, great reputation. And what a better place to gather students from the county, because often they're rural, than to invite them to come in and use that as their Christian community college gathering point. Honestly, the sad part about this is the least productive partner that we've worked with has been our local churches. Hmm. And we are I'm part of the Center for Pastor Theologian group. We're having deep, rich, robust conversations around why the hesitancy for the church to press into this space. Is it desire to not stir the waters? Is it fear of taking on more administration? Why has the church abdicated this formal formational role when it's their birthright? And currently my hope would be that of the Apostle Paul to appeal to them out of jealousy and go to our communities and say, when you're ready to take this space back, it's yours by birthright. The problem is, they don't quite know how to do it yet. So I'm hoping that we can start to stimulate that conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. Todd Wilson from Center for Pastor Theologians lives right by me here in Indianapolis. That's so cool. We don't live right next to each other, but we're in the same city.
That's good.
And, it's interesting. You mentioned these organizations. You know, there's been this massive development of essentially innovative new K-12 educational concepts around things like classical Christian schools, which are exploding. Homeschooling has exploded. Post-pandemic, we were up to 11% of all the kids in the country being homeschooled. They're not all religious homeschooled, mm-hmm. but there are tons of people being homeschooled. And a lot of these people then don't want to send their kids to the same old colleges. Yeah. And kind of the Christian college market has been stagnant. It's struggling and, frankly, is not aligned with the values. Mm-hmm. of the students coming out of these classical Christian schools or homeschooling. So I'm not surprised to see that they might be interested in saying, wow, we need to develop alternatives to the higher ed space because mm-hmm. we don't have anywhere to send our kids.
Right. Yeah. And that has been probably without question, our highest growth area, are classical Christian schools and classical homeschool co-ops that are saying, we've just spent 12 years reading through the greats and engaging in the Western Christian intellectual tradition. What do we do? I mean, there's not very many colleges, even Christian colleges, where our parents are saying, oh yeah, that'll be a great next step.
Right. They all want their kids to go to Hillsdale. Now,
that's right.
Hillsdale, which, you know, I would, you know, question, you know, is it a Christian college? We can have a debate about that. Mm-hmm. Is now down to like only accepting a quarter of the students or so who apply.
That's right.
Whereas the evangelical Harvard of Wheaton accepts 80% plus of all the people that applies. It's basically become almost non-selective at all. And there's a complete misalignment there between the interests of and desires of the families and the Christian higher ed space.
That's right.
Another thing I found interesting was the kind of focus on community college level, because I think you're right. You know, you don't think of Christian community colleges. Mm-hmm. They seem to be all sort of BA type focused institutions, residential campuses, whereas that's only a certain sort percentage of the people are ever going to go to something like that.
Yeah, that's right.
Because, you know, it's like even in the most educated state in the union, which is Massachusetts, that's the only place in the country where even the most educated cohort of young adults, even half of them have a college degree. People don't realize it. Like, we're never going to get much above 40% with degrees, probably, at least if a degree means anything. So we're not addressing the rest of the market there.
That's right. And it's decreasing. You know, males aren't decreasing in their it's the first time in history that we've had less males in college than females, and it's increasing. What's going on? and this was a tough lesson for me to learn, because we're a very educated family. We value this stuff. There was never any question we're going to college, you know, kind of all that stuff. And I'm a college man. You know, I've benefited enormously from my education. But it was when I started to move into the communities that we were building in Brazil. 4 years ago, I came back, grabbed a Suburban, and just started to drive. I drove about 115,000 miles. And every little community, as we were talking to parents and, you know, teachers and students, I was shocked to see how few of our parents were saying, oh, yeah, we really want to send our kid off to that, to the state university. And, you know, whether it was the debt issue or the ideology issue or all this other kind of stuff that was going on. And then COVID hit. And COVID was just like this nuclear bomb that went off that kind of revealed a lot of the deficiencies of many of our universities. And so as I looked at it, certainly the community college popped, because what I found is that every single county, you're in Indiana. So, you know, I go to Lafayette and we open up a little Christian, you know, a Christian hall. Do I have to compete against Purdue? I don't have to compete against Purdue. I can compete against Ivy Tech. Mm-hmm. Ivy Tech sitting right there scraping these students off, you know, with no ideological alignment. And we can come in and say, here are local mentors with job placement opportunities, a accredited top tier Christian university with a no debt option. Which would you rather go to? And it's not even a fair fight.
Right.
And so, you know,
not to besmirch any particular institutions, but lots of community colleges are extraordinarily ineffective providing people with an education that has got a useful skill and produces anything. They're very ineffective.
Well, it's that. And then the other thing that hit me in the face, and I'm never going to abandon the humanities and the classical schools and that kind of stuff. That's kind of my bread and butter, you know, just personally. But the thing that hit me in the face, 3 years ago, a gentleman walked into our home to fix my HVAC system. With these kind of tradesmen, you always wonder, like, do I need to send my kids to the back room? You know, is this going to be a good environment? And this man walked in and he just spread Jesus through my whole house. Like every conversation, the way he talked to my wife, the way he talked to my kids, he discipled us, he blessed us, he loved on us, and he shared Jesus. And I just asked him, I said, man, where would you go to be trained within a Christian worldview and within a skilled trade? And he said, Dr. Ellis, there's not a single accredited trade school in the state of Texas. We abandoned that space 60 years ago with the GI Bill, when all the incentives drove us towards this other kind of educational model. Well, guess what the number one ascending need is in our country is good humane formed skilled tradesmen that will be in our homes and our businesses and working on our cars and all that kind of stuff every single day.
Yeah.
We have no footprint.
Right. And the businesses, you know, I think about it too in terms of if you're a Christian owned business, you know, what are the kind of alignment of the employees you're getting coming out of some of these things? It's more of a concern than ever because employees are a problem. I do know a guy here in Indy who owns a very large electrical contracting firm, and he actually started his own charter school inside his operation where kids come and they basically come out of his program with an associate's degree and a journeyman's card, an electrician, and a job with his company that pays a ton of dough.
That's right.
And so it's a win-win-win for him. Of course, he knows there's a labor shortage. Mm-hmm. But there's also a missional aspect of it because he's working with a lot of challenged kids and all that. He's giving them a viable trade. And, you know, it's not a religious education, but people are being formed in a particular way of living their lives.
Right.
It's very healthy. And so that's just one guy.
That's right.
But there aren't that many, as you said, there's no trade school for that. There's no, and creating a model that could be replicated for other people. Mm-hmm. I think could be valuable with that.
Well, that's kind of what our model is. We look at the local communities. We gain feedback and, you know, field intelligence from our field. And then our job is to go back and create a supply chain so that it's replicable. And so in this case, we went to a couple of our universities, including Southeastern University in Florida. And we said, we've got to attack this trade space. And we don't want to just purely teach people how to wrench. We want to teach good people how to wrench. We want to form good humans, because what our businesses are telling us is like, hey, they could teach people how to do, you know, the wrenching side, but they need good, virtuous people to come into their companies. Right. And so this fall, we're launching the associates to bachelors of skilled trade program with Southeastern, which is basically 50% general education, humanities, kind of the core of the Christian intellectual history, plus a skilled trade that is run by a local master, you know, within their apprenticeship program. And together, you know, you can walk out with a fully accredited associate's or bachelor in a skilled trade. And I frankly think that's going to be our largest program in North America.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of, you know, press into the local communities to respond to the need. I think that's how we can really have tremendous, dramatic impact at the local level. And what's ironic about this is I don't even have to compete against the elite schools. I kind of feel we're a little bit like Toyota and Honda back in the 60s and 70s, where, you know, GM and Chrysler said, oh yeah, you can take that space. You can take the low end car market. And basically, you know, Honda and Toyota came in and ate the long tail and then eventually ate the head. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a very similar space that we're in now. What I hope is, and I think this is kind of the niggling question, I hope that we cannot have to abandon and destroy our legacy institutions. I hope that there is a role for them in this new economy. If they can't figure out how to do it, they're going to go away. But from an efficiency perspective, from a legacy perspective, I think that there is still tremendous value if they can find a way to serve the field, to serve the community, instead of just scraping talent and absorbing their cash and their talent. So, you know, and what do you think about that? Is there a role to redeem and rejuvenate our legacy institutions, or do we just need to abandon it and go?
Well, I think people tend to understate the value of institutions, and it's much harder to create an institution that's any useful than you might think. So I'm certainly of the opinion that we should be on the advance when it comes to institutions, and not in every case does everyone have an opportunity, but where we see an opportunity to steady the ship and reinvent institutions to actually serve, you know, and promote the general welfare properly understood. Yeah. We should definitely do that. I do think with colleges in particular, a lot of these legacy fields, they're very conservative, small C conservative. They don't like change, man. And whether they're willing to do that is an open question.
Mm-hmm.
Reminds me of when the Chicago Tribune one time started doing A-B testing on headlines, and they run the same story with multiple headlines and see which ones the consumer liked the best. The journalist did not like that. They thought that's improper, but like, you know, you got to reinvent this thing or you're not going to have a newspaper. And that's just the reality. I did have one comment here from a listener, a peculiar gentleman, who says, regarding the hesitancy of local elders of churches, I suspect that it is the diversity of differing views on their congregation on education. I think they view it as a church dividing topic. Many congregants will feel guilty if they advocated for this. Do you have any thoughts or reactions on that?
Yeah, I think this, first of all, peculiar gentleman, I think you're absolutely correct. We have constituencies within the church that are attached to legacy institutions, and the same kind of tension that you feel between the homeschool to public school debate. You know, if one is elevated over the other, we're going to, you know, ostracize people that are on one side or the other. We're feeling the same tension because our churches are, by their own nature, little c conservative. They don't like disruption, and they don't like to be seen, by and large, they don't like to be seen as disrupting institutions, especially when you continue to try to appease and play within the halls of power. And Aaron, you've written on this some of, I think, with, you know, some of the conversations around Tim Keller and, you know, what's our posture within society. And this has been a hard thing for me because I'm not really a confrontational person myself. And I tend to want to play nicely, and I want to kind of work within the systems and, you know, not offend people. But I think we're reaching the point now where people are increasingly starting to see there may just be no appeasement. There may just simply be no way to continue to work and appease the powers in the halls of power because they're not going to give. So what are we trying to do? What are we trying to convince them of? Mm-hmm. And I think that tension, our families are willing to go there. Certainly our businesses are willing to go there because the existential threat by their businesses, but our churches still long, you know, they still long for the cultural norm. They still long for the cultural alignment. And I think that does create, you know, the tensions, especially when you have people saying, oh my gosh, my kids are going to go to A&M. You know, that's my driving hope, is that my kids end up going to A&M or Harvard or whatever. And we're saying, maybe it's more important that you know who your daughter-in-law is and where your grandkids are going to live and create a flourishing place of shalom. Maybe that's more important than your kid getting a degree. Those are cultural tension points and fissure points that live in our churches. So I would agree with the comment. Now, how do we share a vision for what is a greater, a better community? You know, that's, I think, the question.
Well, my voice is about totally gone now, so I only got one more question. What is your ambition for Christian Halls?
Oh, well, there's an output ambition, kind of a metric, and there's a visionary metric. I think from the output metric, very simply, we want a Christian community college and trade school alternative in every county of the nation in the next 10 years. I think that is a good goal. It's an attainable goal, and it will be achieved by finding the right multi-generational dynastic families and institutions in our communities that are willing to take back self-governance. That's kind of an output goal. From a vision goal, it's really to reshape the way we think about forming and shaping good people and creating local flourishing. And I think that what that means is re-energizing local mentorship, having a vision for local governance, understanding what, you know, kind of the new American dream is not the old American dream. You know, the new American dream needs to be flourishing local communities. And instead of kind of kowtowing and serving our colonial masters of publishing houses, universities, and institutions, we truly press back into what is the good life, you know, within the kingdom of Christ. And I think that can be part of this educational conversation can be part of that. It's not the only solution. But when I say that we are really truly in the business of re-energizing local eldership, I think that you start to see a cascading effect of questions of employment and family and family structures and business structures. You know, that's the kind of conversation that we want to stimulate. And if we can be the cork in the bottle for some of those conversations, I think that that could be a really good, you know, long-term outcome that could have 50, 100, 150-year impacts. And I think the moment's now. I don't think we've ever been in a situation where there's been more disruption. You know, pick an institution, you know, Methodists, Baptists, Presbyterians, Anglicans, Episcopalians, Catholics. I mean, we have a 900-person Catholic high school in Northeast Dallas that is saying, hey, why couldn't we create a Christian hall? And I'm not Catholic. And their response is, where are we going to send our kids? We can't afford, you know, University of Dallas. We're not going to send them to Notre Dame. We're not going to send them to Marquette. What are we going to do? And so name one institution, especially religious institution, but also our civic institutions that are not in total disruption mode. And I come to the conclusion that we're not that different than the 1490s. That at this moment, the opportunity to rethink how we do human formation is truly a, you know, a 500-year opportunity. And we need the right people with the right desires and kingdom perspective to really be disrupting that space. So that would be my, you know, that would be my long-term hope here.
Well, thanks, Nick. I appreciate it. Again, Nick Ellis, Dr. Nicholas Ellis, is the founder of Christian Halls International, christianhalls.org. There's a link in the show notes, and they are seeking to essentially reinvent Christian higher education for the 21st century. Thank you so much for joining me.
Great to be here. Thanks, Aaron.